Thank you all for coming. One thing I admire enormously about the Aspen Institute Ideas Festival population is your willingness to be thinking and talking and listening, even, you know, through mealtime, from breakfast through dinner. It's an extraordinary amount of energy that you all put into these conversations we're having, which for us is just tremendously exciting. I keep on, you know, falling into conversation on street corners in town and on the walkways here. It just doesn't stop. And I'm very excited for all of us to have a chance to talk with Jim today, because what he is doing right now is both so interesting and so important and exciting. Jim has been a leader in the cause of social justice for more than 30 years, but there has been an ignition, I think, in your ministry, and I use that term in the broadest possible way, in recent years that I think is fascinating given the political landscape that we're operating in, the social and economic landscape. And so what I hope you could do just to get us going is to talk a little about what you mean by revival and what it is that you are trying to make happen right now, where your efforts have been going this year.
Thank you, Nancy. I'm really enjoying myself here at Aspen. Yes, I had sessions on Monday and, no, Tuesday, yes, and then today, but I was off yesterday. And I was just going to panel after panel after panel and talking to lots of people. I had a great time. I was reminded, though, this morning of another place where I was asked to come and speak a few years ago, very different than Aspen or a great university or a church. Invited to come and speak to the inmates at Sing Sing Prison in upstate New York. If you've heard the phrase up the river, that's Sing Sing. It's up the Hudson River. And I got this letter from the prisoners themselves. They said, please come and speak to us. It sounded interesting, so I wrote back, said, sure, when do you want me to come? And this young brother writes back on behalf of his colleagues, and he says, well, we're free most nights. He says, we're kind of a captive audience here. So the authorities in the prison, you know, worked out the details, were very generous. So there I was in Sing Sing prison, left alone with 80 guys for 5 hours and down this room in the bowels of that notorious prison. And one thing one of them said that night, this young kid said that night, I'll never forget, he said, Jim, he said, all of us here at Sing Sing, like almost the whole prison, we come from just 4 or 5 neighborhoods in New York City. 4 or 5 neighborhoods. He said, it's like a train that begins in my neighborhood. You get on when you're 9 or 10 years old, and the train ends up here at Sing Sing. It's an amazing metaphor, this fast-moving urban train beginning in only certain zip codes, going to inevitable destinations. But this young kid, this young man, had a spiritual conversion inside the walls of that prison. The New York Theological Seminary had a program teaching Masters of Divinity inside the prison. So you become a preacher inside the joint. And you graduate when your sentence is up. You know? So this kid looked at me straight in the eye, and he said, when I get out, I want to go back and stop that train. So 2 years later, I'm in New York leading a town meeting on poverty. Guess who's up front? Back home, emceeing the whole night, stopping that train. So, you know, I've been in lots of prisons, and when you're in prison, usually you're poor to start with in most places, and then you're at the bottom. So you're at the bottom of the bottom in prison, usually. But this kid got something that I think we miss, a lot of us miss, which is this, that faith is for the big stuff, the really big stuff, the things that seem impossible, that are too much for us, where the odds are against us. We can't go there. It's just more than we can believe is possible. But that's why we call it faith. See, that's the whole point. And my Bible says that if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move a mountain. That's what the text says. Now, I think we've got some mountains to move, big mountains. When half of God's children, 3 billion of us on this planet, live on less than $2 a day, that's a big mountain. HIV/AIDS pandemic, malaria, these are big, big mountains. Climate change, we've talked about that a lot here, but changing it is a huge mountain to climb. I've been trying to work on Darfur. I mean, if there's anything that we all can agree to change, it's Darfur, but we can't seem to change it because of politics. There are mountains that really have to be moved. And I think faith could help bring us to what Malcolm Gladwell calls the tipping point on many of these issues. Amory Lovins yesterday, we were talking about climate change, and he says, he's been ahead of the world on this topic for years. And the energy panel yesterday, he was in the front row. They're all deferring to him as the sort of the spiritual leader of all this. Amory, as far as I know, is a very secular guy, but he said the entry of evangelical Christians into the global warming issue may become the tipping point on the whole climate change issue. Now, yesterday I made a joke about these two senators in the dining room arguing, Republican Democrat, about who is most religious. It was kind of, I thought, a funny joke. But there's a political joke to go with it, which is this. There's a guy drowning in the Potomac, and he's 100 feet offshore. The Republicans rush down, and they throw him 50 feet of rope, and they say, "The rest is up to you." The Democrats, hearing about the guy and the Republican failure to respond, they rush down, and he's now really going down 100 feet offshore. Democrats throw him 200 feet of rope and then let go of their end. So the point is that it's a funny joke. I hear it out in the country a lot, never inside the Beltway. I think politics is really broken. I know good people on the Hill, both sides, I really do. But it's broken. It's failing to respond to address the biggest issues of our time. In fact, some of the big issues that are affecting the lives of so many people, you can't even vote the right way on because they're not even on the agenda. Like Nick Kristof writes, I love Nick, he writes about things in the Times that no one else wants to write about, but they're like the big issues that affect millions of people and no one's paying attention. So politics is failing. When politics fails to respond to the big issues, the mountains, the moral issues, normally what happens is spiritual movements rise up to change politics and address the issues. And the best social movements generally have spiritual foundations. I want to say from the outset, religion has no monopoly on morality. I'll say it again. Religion has no monopoly on morality. And some of my closest friends and colleagues and soulmates over the years have been very secular, not religious people. But every progressive social movement in our history has also been fueled and driven in large part by religion and faith. There's always this alliance between people of faith and people of deep conscience that move those mountains. Now, we've got... You can't hear? Is it better? All right, let me start again. I did a book called God's Politics, Why the Right Gets It Wrong and the Left Doesn't Get It. The subtitle kind of said it all. I think that's changing now dramatically. And I just finished a new book, and it's not about the right at all. It's about revival. It's called The Great Awakening, Reviving Faith and Politics in the Post-Religious Right Era. Because I think it was happening anyway, but the passing of Jerry Falwell signals the end of an era. The religious right, for you journalists, I see some of you there, the right is there. They're powerful. They have a constituency. They will affect the Republican Party nomination process. But the monologue of the religious right is finally over, and a new dialogue has now begun. And a lot of people point to the very interesting development of Democrats becoming faith-friendly. And we co-hosted a forum with CNN a month or so ago with the leading three Democratic candidates about faith, values, and poverty. And all three Democratic frontrunners happen to be this time serious people of faith for whom it's personal and real, but they connect it to poverty and criminal justice and war and peace and foreign policy, not just abortion and gay marriage. That is important, and the Republicans have a religion problem on their side and a marriage problem and several other problems. But that's not the big story. The big story is how the religious community is changing, and the media is just beginning to get this. There's a profound deepening and widening of the agenda, particularly among evangelicals. And the kind of two-issue moral agenda is really over, even in very conservative evangelical places. Darfur is on the agenda. HIV/AIDS is on the agenda. Global poverty, climate change, Iraq's on the agenda. It's happened even more quickly than I hoped or thought that it might. So there's going to be a whole different conversation now. But I want to suggest, I'm a political junkie, and I went to Terry's panel last night on 08, Campaign 08, and I found it fascinating. Great job. But if we all picked our favorite candidate we'd like to win, and three of them are personal friends, so I like them. However, if our favorite won, they wouldn't be able to change the big issues unless there is a serious social movement outside of politics that is changing politics. So I'm in the movement building business. I relate to the politicians and I try to help them where I can, but I want to build that kind of movement outside. When Desmond Tutu in South Africa was providing such spiritual leadership there, supported the ANC very doggedly. When the ANC became the government, Desmond stepped outside and became a prophetic voice to the new South African government. So I've been in this book research reading about all these revivals in history. I've gotten all excited about what has happened before. You might have seen this new movie, Amazing Grace, the story of William Wilberforce and the 200th anniversary of the end of the slave trade. See the movie. It's a great film. Albert Finney plays John Newton, you know, the one who wrote the song, and he was Amazing Grace, how sweet the sound saved a wretch like me. Well, he wasn't just suffering from existential angst. I mean, he was a wretch. He was a slave trader, and he got converted, and he became eventually an abolitionist, and he found this young parliamentarian named William Wilberforce, who was kind of a young Barack Obama on the way up, and Wilberforce committed his entire career to abolishing the slave trade, then slavery. The bill went forward 10 times before it passed, and it took 30 years to end slavery, and Wilberforce died 3 days later because his work was done. Three things were critical there. One, there was an exemplary leader. But there were, and the movie didn't get the second part right at all. It was a prairie fire movement that swept the UK, even before the internet, swept the country. And then there were the slave revolts in Jamaica that were central. The slaves themselves were a part of this. So I've been reading all these wonderful historical accounts about how Dr. King's faith got more and more personal, the more intense the struggle became, about Desmond Tutu, about Charles Finney in this country, the Billy Graham of his day, invented the altar call, and the reason was to sign up as converts for the anti-slavery movement. That's why we first had an altar call. It was an organizing device for a campaign. So I think we've come a long way since the domination of the religious right, and out in the country, our crowds are large. We've had Barack-sized crowds for 3 years now. On the road, They're half under 30, half of them under 25. And I'm talking to 14-year-olds every week about how their faith could change the world. I'll close with a story. I was in Minneapolis, St. Paul, and I looked at her from the book signing table, and there was this little girl. I said, "How old are you?" She says, "Well, I'm 11. I said, "You're 11, okay. What'd you get from the night?" She says, "Well, I think we're just going to have to change the world." So I said, "Great. Who's going to do that?" "Well, I think people like me." So I tell her story the next night in Tacoma, Washington. I look up. Here's even a littler girl who grins at me and says, "Nine." So I tell their story in Seattle the next night, and I swear, I look up, and here's the littlest one of all, and she says, "I think I'm the youngest so far." I says, "And how old are you?" She says, "I'm 8. My son's 8. I said, "You're 8 years old." "Yeah." I said, what made sense to you tonight, sweetie?" She says, "Well, when you talked about that silent tsunami that happens every day that's killing all those children, you said 30,000 children every day because of hunger and disease. I was just sitting there thinking to myself, if I'm a Christian, I better do something about that." She's in the third grade. So I told my Harvard students the next week, if you want to lead this movement, you better move fast because the whole generation's coming in behind you. So something is happening on the road. I feel it out there every day. It feels to me like the beginnings of revival. So I spend almost none of my time now talking about the religious right. I talk about what faith could do now in our time in a whole different way.
You know, there's a lot I want to ask you about going forward, but I want to look back just for a second because I think a lot of us, and I know I am, are confused about something that happened after the last really great social movement that you talked about, the civil rights movement in the 1960s, which, while it swept up people of all different backgrounds and disciplines, was very conspicuously led by progressive people of faith. And then somehow through the 1970s, something occurred that caused a kind of a retreat and that left us with the landscape that we all have been watching for the last 15 or so years. And I wonder what you think happened. Why did the progressive left, the religious left, as you're often referred to as a leader of the religious left, why did it go underground? It seems too easy to say that it was just because of Roe and the school prayer rulings and the Supreme Court rulings that activated the right. What happened among progressives? And what has happened that has now brought them back in all the ways that you're describing?
Well, it is complicated. There's not any single answer to that. But I think some of the factors are these. I think, Protestant liberalism, the tradition out of which, King was raised in the black church, but then he was schooled in Protestant liberalism. Then he came back to his more personal faith in the heat of the movement. But I think the sort of the progressive mainline churches, they began to lose their... that, you know, God is personal, and it isn't just about social action. It's about a personal God who wants personal relationship, and that got kind of lost in the mainline churches and the evangelical. My tradition, it made it private. So the liberators forgot God was personal. The conservatives made him private, and so I was told at 14. I was asking questions about, in Detroit, my hometown, why did we live the way we did in white Detroit? In black Detroit, life seemed so different. An elder once took me aside and said, I'm a 14-year-old kid, "Jim, Christianity has nothing to do with racism. That's political. Our faith is personal." And I think that's the night that I left in my head and my heart. And so one segment got privatized. One lost its sort of personal grounding in the faith. And then there were meetings in Washington. There were meetings, and some of you journalists know this, and I could name who was there and the dates of the meetings. There were political operatives who called the meetings invited some of the fundamentalist television broadcast preachers, and they made a deal. They said, give us your list, your database, we'll turn our computers on them, and they created a constituency that was designed to gain political power for one party. It was, from the start, it was to win votes in a party by taking private faith public around a couple of issues. A specific abortion and gay marriage later, but sort of the kind of pollution of the culture and pornography and all that. And people think that whole movement was a bunch of theocrats. I think their leaders, I think Pat Robertson is a bona fide theocrat. I think he believes in theocracy. But his troops don't. The constituency, they just feel under assault. The way that most parents, when I, on the road, I say parenting, not I'm a parent, parenting in America is a countercultural activity. Liberals and conservatives shake their heads, nod their heads, because there's all the stuff, the values coming at our kids. They felt under assault, their values are being attacked, and so it's a defensive movement. And some very smart operatives said, we can turn this into political gain. So it became a politicizing of that. And at the same time, then, the secular left, I think, became much more about the politics of rights than the politics of the common good. It became more kind of caucus politics and kind of competing caucuses of rights and no more articulation like King did so well of the common good. So I think, and it became more and more secular, where religion became suspect and part of the problem. And I used to meet people who I had, you know, political sympathies with, and they would say, Jim, you have to understand that in my world, I go for 9 months. These are like journalists, political operatives, and foundation people. I go for 9 months without even meeting anybody who believes in God, you know. So there was a kind of a cultural isolation on the left. So I think those factors allow this movement to really move forward. But I think it's all broken down. I think Cal Thomas, conservative columnist, says that we didn't get much for the bargain that we made in terms of our issues. He's still a conservative. A new generation wants a different agenda, a wider agenda. And I think the left, the Democrats, are finally waking up to their own history of progressive religious movements at the heart of social change. So I think things are shifting now dramatically. And I'm basically a 19th century evangelical born in the wrong century. Because back then, evangelicals led the way in abolition of slavery and women's suffrage and child labor law reform. What you see now is a new generation of 19th century evangelicals for a 21st century. The media used to always say, they call me a progressive evangelical. A progressive evangelical, they said, was a misnomer. And now it's becoming a movement. We've gone from misnomer to movement. And I got a whole generation as proof of that now.
The politics of poverty strikes me as being especially complicated. The Barna Group, which, as you know, does a lot of national polling on religious attitudes, came out with a poll last week or the week before that found that evangelical Christians were half as likely as the average American to list poverty as a major social problem. Not only were evangelicals not more likely to cite poverty as a major social challenge, they were half as likely to as the average. Can you explain that? Does that make sense to you, that finding?
No, it doesn't. John Green's done some polling, particularly now among younger evangelicals, college campuses. And I know for a fact that polling would be much higher. In fact, there's a new kind of wave of student activism growing now on campuses. And what's interesting, where it's happening is much more the evangelical Christian campuses and the Jesuit Catholic schools. That's where I'm going, you know. It's not happening at the liberal left bastions of progressivism in the past as much. And so I think there's a generational issue there. I'd like to look at his data. But the kind of poverty as an issue that's rising among, like Rick Warren, poverty doesn't occur That word doesn't occur in Rick's purpose-driven life book. It's not even there. But I met Rick at Davos 2 years ago, and we were spent the better part of three days together. And he's obsessed by poverty and AIDS in Africa. And he says, how did I miss those 2,000 verses in the Bible about poor people? I've been in two seminaries. I got a PhD. How did I miss this purpose of God? And I hear this all the time. There's a second tier of megachurch pastors below Rick Warren and Bill Hybels. And they're the ones to really watch. And they've got large churches, 6, 7, 8, 10,000. And they're young. And poverty is their driving issue. Poverty, AIDS, climate change, these are their driving issues. And one of them is the second largest church in Ohio, in Columbus. So that's so the BBC camps out in his living room because Ohio's a swing state. And he just came and spoke at our conference. So there's a whole generation now that are going to put new things on the agenda. Now, there is some generational difference here. So there may be some of that still going on.
If we've moved past the argument about whether people of faith should be engaged in politics and it's about how they should, this campaign seems to... That's a very lively question right now. You saw John McCain's religious outreach people quit with the charge that all he wanted was for us to gather up church directories and hand over mailing lists to him. We saw David Kuo, who's an evangelical Christian in the Bush White House, working on faith-based initiatives, who not only walked away heartbroken at what he felt was just the manipulation of people of faith, but he said that people of faith ought to be taking a fast from politics. And that the right thing for people to do now is to pull out of the political process and to tend their own garden, to help the poor and fight for justice independent of the political system, because the political arena involves too much compromise, too many things that are essentially unholy. How do you answer that?
David called me after he said that. He said, well, of course, I didn't mean your kind of politics. David's been burned badly by the White House initiative on faith and community, and many others feel burned. And there is a kind of a tendency to say the problem is getting involved in politics, and it's a reaction to the religious right and the way they did it. We don't want to do that, and we don't want to just be a religious left. And even though in the media, as you said, I'm sometimes referred to as a leader on his left, I don't consider myself that. We don't need a religious left to counter a religious right, because left and right are not religious categories, and they don't fit religion. They squeeze it into narrow partisan boxes. And when we're at our best, we are pulling people from across the political spectrum around the big issues, the mountains, the big moral questions. Richard Land, who was here last year, he and I have been working together on Darfur. We go to the White House together on Darfur. That's a powerful 1-2 combination. Immigration reform, we're cross-cutting on that. Climate change, certainly. You know, Rich Cizik was going to come this week, and he's obsessed with creation care, he would call it. This is a life issue for him. It's a pro-life issue for him. So when we get people from the left and the right together on some of the great moral issues, that's when you can really shift and change politics. But there is this fear about political engagement. So I was talking, an example, with one of these second-tier megachurch pastors, and he showed me his huge facility that's doing legal services for the poor, the computers for kids, a medical clinic. I mean, it's the best I've ever seen, and it was... There's so many people in this church, it was like paid for before they finished it. No mortgage, nothing. They're surrounded by Section 8 housing, and they're going to do a great job. This is Rich Nathan in Columbus, Ohio. He says, I'm struggling with this whole notion of the role of government and our role and who should do what. And people tell me that we shouldn't get involved in politics and we should just do it ourselves. We do it better, you know. I said, Rich, you got three choices. You can say that we do this better. It's our job to serve the poor, And I'm convinced, having seen your facility, you'll do this well in this neighborhood. And anybody who can swim to your island of hope is going to be taken care of. But a lot of people in this nation have nowhere to swim to, don't know even which direction to swim in or can't swim. And if the congregation you have right now pursues their natural political inclinations, you're going to support policies that will make all them drowned. Second option is you can say the government shouldn't do it. Liberals say government should do all this, not churches. Let them do it. Third option is you lead by example. You do this, and you do it in a way that prompts others to do more and do better. You challenge the political leadership in this city, in this county, in the state, to do a better job themselves by your example. You're not letting them off the hook. You're saying you've got to do better, too. It's like in New Orleans. The government on every level failed to respond. It is true that churches responded much faster, much better, more timely, and even many conservative churches. It's true. But you know what? Churches can't rebuild levees. They can't provide health insurance for 47 million people who don't have it. They can't provide living wage jobs. Churches can't do all this. They can lead, however, by example. Red Rich said, I know what I'm doing. So guess who was at the ribbon-cutting ceremony of their thing? The mayor, the county commissioner, his member of Congress. And he was saying, we're going to work in partnership. We're going to work with you, but we're going to hold you accountable to serving the poor in this city, in this county, in this district, in the state. So I think those folks are finally getting that the movement is not from service, if you will, to partisan politics. That's what the right did. The movement is from service to movement that changes politics. And that's a much more acceptable move for them to make. Go to a movement that changes politics, challenges politics. Don't just enlist in the database of the Democrats now like the right did for the Republicans.
You talked at the outset about your forum, the Call to Renewal Forum at the beginning of June, where the leading, and many of you will have, I'm sure, watched this on CNN, the three leading Democratic candidates answered questions about their religious values and spiritual life and issues of social justice. And you're going to do the same, you're inviting the Republicans to do the same thing in the fall. What was so interesting is that is a kind of debate that I don't think we would have seen even 4 years ago. Even that species of debate was a new ingredient in our political discourse. So I'm curious about what you think it is okay for journalists or voters to ask candidates for president about their religious beliefs. Is it okay to ask Mitt Romney whether he thinks Jesus will return to Jackson County, Missouri one day? Is it okay to ask Hillary if she believes in the literal truth of Scripture, or ask Giuliani if he believes in transubstantiation? How much and when and what kinds of questions about belief are legitimate, and which kinds do you think are out of bounds?
That's a great question. I believe strongly in the separation of church and state. That doesn't mean the segregation of moral values from public life or the banishing of religious reference or conviction from the public square. King invoked Jeremiah, Amos, and Jesus. But when he began to make his argument about what should happen in the country, he didn't say, I'm a Christian, so in a Judeo-Christian country, I get to win. He never did that. He made an argument. He knew he had to win the debate. He had to persuade his fellow citizens that a Voting Rights Act in 1964, Civil Rights Act, Voting Rights Act, were in the best interest of the country, not just the Baptists or the believers. It was for the common good. So there can't be a religious litmus test. The other day I was on one of the cable shows, and it was Larry King, and I said, there should not be a religious litmus test applied to Mitt Romney. I was in Michigan. His dad was my governor. It was never an issue. He was a good governor. What his theology is should not be an issue. It is legitimate to ask a candidate what their moral compass is. That'll shape their policy, their leadership, their choices. And if religion shapes their moral compass, then it's fair to ask how their religion shapes their moral compass and will shape their leadership on matters of public policy. But I don't think it's the business of the press to be, you know, parsing theological doctrine with candidates. But it is fair to say how do you connect your faith to these big issues like poverty and like all the things that we talked about on CNN? So I think it's a fair conversation to have religion in the discussion, but we don't want exegetical arguments on the Senate floor about the meaning of Leviticus. That's not where we want to go here. So I think the difference between not litmus test, but moral compass and how it shapes, I think. And King was very good at distinguishing that. He was not unapologetic, a Baptist minister, but he made he knew he had to win the debate about what's best for the common good. And religion, that just means religion must be disciplined by democracy.
Every poll, though, shows that the one kind of person who a majority of people say they wouldn't vote for is an atheist. Is that a religious test?
The polls do show that, and I want to say, as a person of faith, as someone who's called a religious leader, I think that is very, very sad. Martin Luther said, "I'd rather be governed by a competent Turk than by an incompetent Christian." Martin Luther said that. I would vote for an agnostic or an atheist if I trusted their moral compass over a Christian whose competence and compass I did not trust. So I guess I'm in the minority on that poll.
I want to give you all a chance to ask anything you like. So you can either speak really loudly, or I'll bring you a microphone, or however will work best. Yes, ma'am.
I have a question. Since you said it, my heart's kind of been beating a little fast. Before the little girl said, "Well, I'm a Christian, so I'm going to do all I can."
Right.
And I'm going to say to you that I think people, I lived in Texas for 22 years, which is the gold buckle of the Bible Belt. And people tend to oversimplify things. And if you look in the Yellow Pages in Dallas, Texas, when they advertise businesses, they put the little Jesus fish, the ichthys, in the corner to show you that, well, if you do business with me, I do it the right way.
Right.
Don't call the Jewish guy or the other guy.
Right.
I do it the right way.
Christian culture.
She said, "I'm a Christian, so I'll have to do something about that. My daughter's been told she'll rot in hell in eternity if she doesn't accept Jesus in her heart." She was 5.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to say to you, when someone tells you that, and you are a man of the Christian faith, if you want a groundswell of people coming behind you, and know this is a Judeo-Christian country with plenty of Hindus, Muslims, atheists, and everything,
right,
maybe you can come up with a better word, because if you look at the record, Jews were marching hand in hand in Selma, Alabama.
Sure.
And Jews were at the forefront of the labor unions to get a 40-hour work week. And I think by this whole, "I'm a Christian, so I'll drink behind the back of everybody, or I'll do this wrong, but I'm a Christian, so I do the right thing," is so hard and so hurtful,
mm-hmm,
that if you can come up with a better way to say, check, like you're saying, check your moral compass. And you do say it's a Judeo-Christian country, yet when people are Christians, they don't say, "I'm a Judeo-Christian."
Mm-hmm.
They say, "I'm a Christian."
Right.
It's so exclusionary,
sure, yeah,
for everybody else.
Well, there are more Muslims now in America than Presbyterians. Don't tell the Presbyterians that, but it's true. In this new book, there's a whole section on the common good, and there are wonderful, I love that term, because there are wonderful multiple sources, Catholic social teaching, you know, Judaism, and I'm learning a lot more about Islam and the common good. I'm learning there's a whole common good tradition in Islam. So there's a lot about Heschel in my book, a lot about who marched with King and Selma hand in hand. Heschel is a mentor of mine. His book on the prophets has shaped my whole life. So that little girl, I don't think in her head was all the stuff. I know that Texas culture too. I think she was just saying, if I'm a person of faith, if I believe the things I'm taught to believe, then I got to do something about that. But it could be easily, if I'm really a Jew, if I'm a Muslim, or I'm just a person of conscience, I can't let that 30,000 kids dying every day means literally one every 3 seconds. And I snapped my fingers that night like that. And it just hit her like a bolt to her heart. The thing she had been taught about her Christian faith and her family was just contrary to that being okay. She was just saying, I got to do something about that because of my faith. Now, in our context, it can't be just Christian. We are a nation of many faiths and no faith at all. The largest growing population right now is people of no faith, 7% to 14% in the last couple decades. Because, why? Because of the kind of Christian culture that you're describing from Texas. That's turned a lot of people away from Christian faith or any kind of faith. You probably don't know our work that much, but in Sojourners, we've spent a whole lot of our time talking about bad religion. I think the answer to bad religion is not necessarily secularism, but is better religion. And better religion is the kind that always makes common cause. Always, always, always. One time we had an action in D.C., and it was, you won't believe this, but they were actually cutting programs for poor people and cutting taxes for the rich. You won't believe that our legislators would do that, but that's what they were doing. So a number of grassroots, sort of on the ground, Catholic sisters and Black church pastors wanted to have a statement about that in the rotunda. And so I said, okay. And then a rabbi called me, a friend of mine said, you got room for a rabbi? I said, sure, we're going to read Isaiah. You can do the text. So he came, and the text was, woe to you legislators who pass infamous laws, denying the poor among my people of their rights. So we all wore our clergy costumes and went to the rotunda of the U.S. Capitol, and we prayed and sang and read scripture. And we were when you do that in the rotunda, you are arrested and taken to jail. There was an eighth grade civics class, happened to be in the rotunda that day, learning about how the government works. And the New York Times interviewed one of the kids and said, what'd you learn about civic engagement today? He said, well, and they led us away, and the kids were all bug-eyed. He said, sometimes you got to stand up for what you believe, and when you do, it's good to have some people with you. We all went to jail. And here's my friend Tony Campolo with his Jewish rabbi, and we're all three of us are friends. And they're having in the D.C. jail, a serious theological conversation about who was Jesus. You know, was he the Son of God? Was he a prophet? A serious Christological conversation in the D.C. jail, you know? And it was their friends, but it was a good theological dialogue. And I thought, this is it. This is the interfaith. This is how you do it. You all get arrested for your faith and discuss theology in jail. You know, so we have to find some ways to collaborate together. It's a diverse nation. It's pluralistic. And everything I'm saying has to respect the pluralism and diversity, which is now religious and non-religious America. And I think we can. I think we should.
Yes, sir.
You talked about having a serious theological discussion, and I live in Texas as well, and their idea of a serious theological discussion is why we both believe in Jesus. But can you give how do you propose to have a serious theological discussion across the country with Muslims, atheists, Jews, Christians, all who have very distinct ideas and varying levels of education?
Well, I was in Fort Worth a while back. That's still in Texas. And they were having an imam come during the week to have a conversation. And they expected 50, and they got 300 Christians to come to listen to this. So there is that religion has been divisive, hierarchical, patriarchal, sectarian, and violent. It has been. It has been all that. It also has been, in other times and places, a catalytic, mobilizing, transforming force that has turned things upside down. The slave owners gave the slaves that book, the Bible, to turn their eyes in heaven and take their eyes off their plight on the earth. But in the book, the slaves found Moses and Jesus, who became the foundation for their liberation struggle. It's always both. I'm actually hopeful from what I'm seeing around the country about a new conversation that applies faith to all of life on a broader agenda and is willing to listen to people who have a different theological stance. We've got a long way to go. There's a lot of preaching and not listening going on, as we heard last night. But I'm hearing a new conversation now that I'm actually pretty encouraged about.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, they do tend to move in waves. See, I think there wouldn't have been a civil rights movement without the animating foundation of the black churches. That, to me, was the last of the great revivals in recent time. This one, I feel like it feels to me like we're ripe for revival again. I think the issues are becoming clear that it's going to address. I see a generation coming kind of onto the stage that is ready for a new definition of their faith. And a lot of us are having a lot of conversation about thinking movement. How do you think movement? How do you build the infrastructures, the relationships, the connections? How do you build the sustaining devices? Because I don't think you can be a social activist for a long time without also becoming a spiritual contemplative. I really don't. The quest for spirituality in an affluent society can easily become quite narcissistic. Spirituality is one more commodity, one more tape or book or guru or weekend away, unless it's disciplined by the struggle for justice. But the struggle for justice, if it isn't rooted somewhere in a spirituality, can become angry and burnout and despairing, hostile, ideological, and even violent. And so how do you have that balance between social justice and spirituality? Those are the two great hungers I said yesterday or Tuesday. The two great hungers I find out there are the hunger for spirituality and the hunger for social justice. And the connection between the two is the one the world's waiting for. So sustaining it, I think, is sustaining that balance. And we're already talking about how to build in that balance, how to sustain that balance between the spirituality and the social justice, so we don't just burn ourselves out in two or three or four or 5 years. Wesley lit a fire and Wilberforce caught fire, and then it became the Methodist Church, an institution like all others. So I probably wouldn't want to say that if this revival happens, it'll be like a revival like never before. It just will never end. I suspect there'll be a wave, there'll be a cycle, and things will. Then another generation down the road will say, wait a minute, this is all institutional religion. It's not engaged in the world. It's time for us to put faith, you know, back in the streets. And someone else, you know, my great-grandkids will come along and we'll do it again. Terry, you want to?
Yes, I'm sorry. Oh, Terry, yes. And then you may.
I wonder if you'd want to comment on the role of the Catholic Church, the Roman Catholic Church, and the Conference of Bishops in the public sphere. As we saw it, let's say, in 2004, and as we might anticipate it in 2008, both with regard to the issues you're talking about and the individual theology and behavior of canons.
Bernardin was a cardinal in Chicago, my favorite cardinal. I miss Cardinal Bernardin. He had this thing called the consistent ethic of life, the seamless garment, where all the threats to life were of concern to him, be they abortion was a concern of his, but so was nuclear war, so was poverty, so were a whole range of things. If what happened in 2004 would have happened when he was alive or a few others, there would have been much more pushback. It happened from really a handful of bishops on the right. This is the connection between, you know, John Kerry and being denied Eucharist because of his abortion stance. It made headlines across the country. In my view, there would have been in the past more pushback from more moderate bishops than there was this time. Cardinal McCarrick said a few things. I think they could have been stronger. But they were on page 16, and the story was on page 1. And I think John Kerry handled it very badly himself. He never figured out how to respond as a Catholic, which he could have done better. I've actually talked to the Conference of Bishops about this since then, and a lot of them weren't particularly happy with some of the things that happened and how they happened. I think there has to be a much... You just can't say this is the only issue. Catholic social teaching is much broader than just the issue of abortion. You know, Georgetown did their commencement this spring. Jesuit teaching goes way beyond just that single issue. And many Catholics were unhappy with their church becoming a single issue church. And they also forget that when George Bush went to Rome, John Paul agreed with him on abortion, but shook his finger at him about Iraq, and which the Pope was against war in Iraq. So were the Catholic bishops. And that somehow wasn't brought into the conversation during the election season because these right-wing bishops probably weren't. So I think it was I felt it was politicized, and if you look at the websites, the sort of Catholic right wing websites, they were all not just harmonized, they were homogenized. They all had the same stuff, same bullet points, and they were really, it was a page out of the RNC. So I think there was a real collusion going on there. A politicizing of the church that can happen from the right or the left, and I think it was a mistake. So I'd like to see a broader, deeper conversation, this time from the Conference of Bishops. I'd like their pamphlet called Faithful Citizenship is a terrific guide to how Catholics ought to vote. And it's not just about abortion. It's about the poor. It's about the environment. It's about a whole range of things. We use that guide. It's a very good guideline, and it wasn't really prominent in the 2004 election because a campaign got going among the bishops, in my view.
I'm afraid this is going to have to be our last question. Yes, ma'am. Mm-hmm.
Thanks for you, and thanks for this. I'd like to ask you a question about social movements.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. He doesn't talk about spirituality. He doesn't talk about
Well, I'm for all those three. And we spend a lot of time working on all of those three. But you need some juice. You need some juice, some energy, some transformative power. You need some, and it doesn't have to be religious, but it's got to be a spiritually transformative power. People have to be willing to put their lives on the line. They've got to be willing to sacrifice. We won't change this stuff with just good education, you know? So how do you, go ahead, you want to, look like you're going to, okay. There's a real conversion is tied up with movements. People join the civil rights struggle, not just because they read an article, it sort of made sense, and they decided to join. And this is true of people who are religious or secular. I mean, friends of mine who were secular then, deeply involved, secular still, will tell you that the church service the night before the march in the streets, those were, in their words, the spiritual high points of their lives. Because to respond with nonviolence to police dogs and clubs and water cannon, you had to be spiritually prepared. And so how do we change our values and our understandings, our sensibilities, our habits, our ways of looking at the world? Movements do that. They change people, and they change cultures. They don't just change politics. The change happens in Washington last. You know, King, unlike the religious right, which was, they set up camp in a political party. That's what there's right to. King never did that. He worked the cores of power, he did, but his base was outside of them. Lyndon Johnson was not a civil rights leader until King and Rosa Parks made him one. Movements make politicians into political leaders. And those are my sort of models. Gandhi, be the change you want for the world. You know, Gandhi wasn't just negotiating with the British. His fight with the British was probably not quite as intense as his fight with his own people about how they had to change. They had to be ready for independence. He postponed independence to the chagrin of the Congress Party leaders because we aren't ready for it yet, he said. And he'd fast for years at a time because we weren't ready for it yet. Real movements, and this is where the rights got it right. The rights figured out that changing culture finally will change things more than changing politics. It'll change politics, but you got to change culture first. Movements change culture. So I want to change politics, but I want to change culture. And let me just finish with a kind of a funny story about that same movement. I went to Ebenezer. If you're a preacher, going to Atlanta is like being a kid in the candy store. Because Atlanta, everybody, they preach at 7-Elevens in Atlanta, you know. And so I went back on the book tour to Ebenezer Baptist Church, one of my favorite places to preach. Joe Roberts was just retiring. He was there welcoming me back. He says, you've been in the old Israel, the historic Auburn Avenue Church. This is the new Israel, the new sanctuary, 2,000 seats, all full that night, but felt intimate still. He reminded me of my first time there when I was much younger, a long time ago. The first King legal holiday, Ebenezer decided to have a peace and justice service. And they invited this young white preacher to come. And I was honored, but I was terrified about the idea of being in that pulpit. I mean, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. had preached here. His father, Daddy King, had preached. The whole movement had preached here. And what was this white kid from Detroit doing in that pulpit? And sure enough, I just froze. And I was quite tepid in my opening remarks. I said, well, Dr. King, he was for justice and peace, and probably we should be too. It was powerful. It was really powerful, you know. And left side, down low, this voice boomed back at me. Oh, help him, Lord, help him. Help him, Lord. Young man, you're supposed to preach. And so I began to preach a little bit. Oh, you're not there yet. You're not there yet. In the tradition of the black church, call and response, he welled me, he mercied me, he amen me, he said, preach it, brother, until I was preaching and prancing and sweating all over that stage, and I was exhausted when I was done. And I ran down there, and I said afterwards, I said, "Hey, this is the Amen Corner, if you know the tradition, of Ebenezer Baptist Church." I said, "You, this is Deacon Johnson." I said, "You just pulled that sermon out of me." He stood up tall, Deacon Johnson. He put his hands on my shoulders. "Young man, I've raised up many a preacher in my time." And I remembered that night how bad religion really does. We got some bad stuff in us. We do. Bad religion brings out our worst stuff, the stuff she was talking about, our divisions, our intolerance, our self-interest, our hatred, our violence. Good religion can pull out our best stuff, our compassion, our hunger for justice, our desire for peace, our willingness to listen to each other and believe that we all are the children of God. We've had too much bad religion. I think it's time for some good religion. Thank you very much.